welcome to the Backdoor to Monarchy episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Stacey Marie Ishmael of Bloomberg.
Hello.
We're also here with Emily Peck of Fundrise.
Hello. Hi.
Hello. And we are going to talk about rich men this week, because apparently on a money show, this is inevitable on a regular basis. We are going to talk about all of the billionaires who have managed to avoid a billionaire tax and why that might be. We are going to talk about Mark Zuckerberg, who's extremely rich and who has pivoted his company. We are going to talk about Elon Musk and Tesla and how his new deal with Hertz might change things around. We're going to talk about, in Slate Plus, we're going to talk about Edward Rogers, who is attempting a very succession-style coup up in Canada. It's all manner of fun and games all coming up on Slate Money.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Mark Zuckerberg, thank you very much for rebranding your company and forcing us to talk about what I guess we should now be calling Meta rather than Facebook. Although I suspect that people are still going to call Facebook Facebook, much like they still talk about National Airport. Stacey, give me a quick picture of what did Mark Zuckerberg announce and does it matter?
What Mark Zuckerberg announced this week is that Facebook, as he has alluded to several times in the past, is really betting its present and future on the idea of what's called the metaverse, this immersive, experiential, virtual reality, video gamey feeling situation in which all of our quote unquote real life interactions will happen in environments that seem to come more from science fiction than they do the real world.
So he's investing a bunch of money into Oculus, which is the sort of headset company that he bought. He's investing a bunch of money into AR, which is augmented reality. And he's saying that this is the new way that we are going to sort of interact with the world. This is going to replace the internet and apps on our phones. And that's his big bet. What does that mean for Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp and all of these apps that he's made all of his billions of dollars from? Like, are they just going to keep on going as they already did? Are we going to see any changes to them?
I think one of the most interesting questions for me, and this is where my deep skepticism of the idea that any of this is actually going to be interoperable comes from, is one, will most people adopt this at the rate that Facebook wants them to or Meta wants them to, right? Like the Oculus headset has been out for a long time. It is a good seller, but you canvas 10 normal looking people not wearing fleeces on the street and you ask them, hey, have you ever used a VR headset? And they're not going to be like, yeah, totally. So they're going to put themselves in this interesting product cycle where they have to keep doing the thing they're doing now that's, you know, super profitable for them, and also aggressively try to drive adoption of entirely different kinds of both hardware and software experiences that most folks have frankly been really skeptical of.
Facebook's problem is the problem of so many tech companies over so long, which is that young people don't use Facebook anymore and the brand name is kind of tarnished, and trying to pivot to do another thing that's kind of cool and they hope will catch on with young people is a huge gamble that historically doesn't really pay off. Like Microsoft is a good example of a company that like pivoted to not caring about young people at all and adoption, and is doing more, you know, like B2B business and has been enterprise and has been successful at it. It's sort of like grew up alongside.
But they did buy Minecraft, right?
True. But I feel like
that's a play on parents.
I just like Facebook has lost the youngs, and it doesn't seem like they're going to get them back, even if they do something that young people might want to adopt and understand, because there are other brands already doing this ahead of Facebook, right, Stacey? Like Roblox, we mentioned already.
Every video game company pretty much is trying to solve this. And I also think folks like, you know, Apple has been very early on really investing in what Felix alluded to, you know, AR, augmented reality, the idea that you like look through your phone and it gives you another layer in the reality you're already in, as opposed to being in something that's completely immersive and virtual. I mean, the other thing too is, you know, Emily, you're having internet problems. Like one of the fun things about VR is it's incredibly bandwidth intensive. Right? Anything where you're like fully experiential, I'm looking around and I'm surrounded by a tropical island, but I'm actually still in my living room. You are not going to get that experience on 4G, my man. That's not a thing that's going to happen. So how they're going to solve that ongoing problem of hundreds of millions of people around the world barely even having any kind of internet access, I think is also kind of scary when I think about the techniques they've used in the past.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is really contingent on widespread availability of 5G. And I have to say, I'm a 5G skeptic. I'm not convinced that that is going to exist in the world wherever you walk and wherever you want to be. What I do think is going on here is that we're seeing something incredibly consistent with what Facebook has been from the very beginning, which is a company absolutely obsessed with growth at all costs. Growth is the only thing that matters. Famously, in the early days of Facebook, there was this growth team which basically ran the company, and whatever the growth team wanted, the growth team got, and if it wasn't what the growth team wanted, it never happened. And it worked. Facebook grew incredibly fast, and when the Facebook app growth looked like it might slow down, like, you know, once you had like 100% penetration in the United States and that kind of stuff, they decided they were going to grow another way by buying Instagram. And then they grew by buying WhatsApp. And the one thing that Facebook has always wanted, and Mark Zuckerberg has always wanted, and Sheryl Sandberg has always wanted, is where is the astonishing future growth going to come from? And this, to me, is entirely like in line with that. They know that there's no more major acquisitions that they would be allowed to do. You know, both the US and the European antitrust authorities would just squash that in a heartbeat. They tried to do this Libra e-commerce cryptocurrency thing that fell flat on its face, and they realized they weren't going to get any massive growth from that. And so now they've decided they're going to build something else. And the great thing about building something rather than buying something is that the antitrust authorities can't stop you from building something. They've already bought Oculus. That's in the past. No one's going to unwind that Oculus acquisition. And so they're like, our future growth is going to come from the metaverse. Now, I don't believe that growth story about the future. I don't think. I think with Stacey, I'm with you on this one. I'm skeptical that they're going to see the kind of growth from the metaverse that Mark Zuckerberg claims to be betting his company on. But I also think he has no choice. I think that if he really wants growth at all costs, despite the fact that he's already a massive in globe spanning company, and he still wants to get bigger, then it's this or nothing. So he chose this.
Yeah, I think that's right. They're not allowed to buy their way or acquire their way out of the situation they're in. They had to create something. They have no real track record of creating anything besides Facebook initially. They haven't really
innovated. Do you remember the Facebook phone?
Yeah.
They've tried. But I think the weird thing to me here is that this is exactly what you don't need to do. If you're Mark Zuckerberg and you have control of your company, and we will talk a little bit about what that means in Slate Plus with what's going on with Rogers Communications in Canada, but he has complete control of the board. He has complete control of the company, and he is not beholden to outside shareholders who are saying, you need to keep on growing or I'll, sell my stock or whatever. Like, he can do what he likes. Why does he feel like he needs to grow? Is he not big enough already? Why can't he, concentrate on the incredible problems that we have learned so much about within his company that have emerged over the past few weeks, first from the Wall Street Journal and then from everyone else on the planet? Why can't he really try and fix everything that's broken with Facebook rather than spending a huge amount of bandwidth and executive time pivoting to some pipe dream?
One thing I've always found fascinating about engineering cultures is nobody likes to fix bugs, but everybody likes to build new things, right? And it is really boring, frankly, and this is like an intensely widespread perception in lots of types of corporate cultures and tech that I've interacted with, to be told that, no, you have to slow down because this one thing over here isn't working properly. And I do think that the reaction to the most recent set of, whistleblower documents is revealing in that sense, because this is not the first document up by any means. We've had various other things come out about, genocide in Myanmar, what's happening with Indian elections, the complete lack of scalability in terms of being able to moderate various kinds of local languages. So it's not that Facebook was kind of coming into this unaware, internally, externally, that they had a bunch of things they could be working on to sort out. It's just that it's very hard to reconcile, do the fundamental infrastructure stuff to kind of keep people safe, even if it's much less glamorous and the press is still going to be mad at you, even if you think you're trying really hard, versus we're going to do a big, shiny, incredible rebrand and we're going to get wall-to-wall coverage from every single media company in the entire world, and we're going to make them think about the future for a second, versus that thing that everybody's been doing, which is reminding us that we made mistakes before.
I don't think it's even only tech culture. Now I'm thinking about politics and the impetus to build the new bridge instead of fixing all the old bridges that are crumbling. It feels very similar.
Shiny is shiny.
Yeah, and it's the same thing that you see at art museums. They're much more likely to do a massive capital campaign to build a sexy new wing designed by Stephen Hall than they are to invest in conservation efforts for their permanent collection.
Sometimes the future is really just pretending that the past didn't happen.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fracturing me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
So enough about Mark Zuckerberg. Let's talk about Mark Zuckerberg. He has actually paid a decent amount of tax. When Facebook went public, he paid like $1 billion tax bill. But he has made much, much more than that. And he has paid no tax on most of the money that he's made in his life. If you think of the money that he's made in his life as being the value of his stock in Facebook. And this is true for like most of the big name billionaires that come to mind these days, whether it's Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, the money they make is generally untaxed. Even Warren Buffett is the same way. And so the question then arises, if the government wants to pay for big social infrastructure and spending bills rather than just borrow the money, doesn't it make sense to tax the very rich? And if it does make sense to tax the very rich, that would like reduce inequality, redistribute a bunch of wealth, and pay for a bunch of programs that the government wants to do, you know, win-win-win, we should tax the wealthy rather than just the people with high incomes. And so this week, Senator Ron Wyden came out with a plan that would do that, basically ask the likes of Mark Zuckerberg to pay capital gains tax on their capital gains, whether they'd sold their stock or not. And this lasted, I think, about 6 hours before Senator Joe Manchin decided he didn't want to do it, and so it died. My theory is that a wealth tax is basically a step too far. And this wasn't technically a wealth tax. It was just a capital gains tax. But it's a step too far. And for weird sort of cultural reasons, it's going to be really, really hard to get any kind of thing looking that looks like that through America's Congress, because this is America, goddammit.
I thought it was more like, and jump in if I have this wrong, but basically the concept of taxing gains in your stock that you haven't sold yet is like too hard for people to do. Like that's what seemed like the stumbling block was, just like, it's just too hard. It's ridiculous. We can't do it because it's hard. And we're instead going to raise taxes on just regular millionaires.
If you look at the proposal that Wyden Club published, and it was a very detailed, it was a 107-page bill, and there was like this big, long 17-page explanation of how it worked. Like, it's really quite easy. Any of us can do it, to look at like, what are the unrealized capital gains on your stock market portfolio? Like, if you have a stock market portfolio, there's a very good chance that like you can just log onto your brokerage account and it will tell you to the nearest dollar what the unrealized capital gains are. And then you just take that number and you multiply it by 23.8%, and boom, that's how much you owe in taxes if you are a billionaire or if you have more than $100 million of income. Now, there might be ways to hide, you know, to avoid some of those taxes, or, you know, in a legal way. But in theory, at least for those liquid assets that you needed to pay tax on that year, I don't think it's that hard to do.
I mean, whenever somebody's like, it's too hard, so I'll spend my money going to Mars instead, I'm like, let's talk about the relative complexity of having an army of lawyers and accountants to figure this out versus like literally trying to fly to another planet, right? It's up there with the rhetoric that, yes, I will pay more taxes if the money were better spent. Like, sure. Would you, like, what is this ideal, perfect allocation of resources with which you approve, you know, that you want the government to act like a donor-advised fund, that you are going to specifically sign off on the individual bridges that they want to spend your taxes on? It's just, the sums involved here are so wild. And, you know, I saw some data that came out either yesterday or today, Friday, about like there were more than 100 new billionaires added during the past 18 months when so many people were losing jobs and so many people were trying to figure out just how to survive. And so this idea that doing something that would take an amount of money away that is not spendable by anybody anyway, in any realistic way, even if we did fly to Mars, is, you know, like a moral outrage, is a position I as a person cannot understand.
It might not be a moral outrage. I think the more germane argument against it is that it's a constitutional outrage. And we've talked about this on the pod with Anna Szymanski, who was a great, great fan of this constitutional argument against a wealth tax, which is actually a real argument. A wealth tax on its face would be unconstitutional. A wealth tax of the type that Elizabeth Warren had proposed would probably be unconstitutional.
I don't understand how it would be unconstitutional. Like, I pay my property tax. Could you explain more how it's unconstitutional? Because I do not understand how it's unconstitutional.
Okay, I will explain how it's unconstitutional. Property taxes are state taxes. They're not federal taxes. States can do what they like, basically, in terms of taxation, but the federal government can't. The federal government is constrained by Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution, which bans any capitation or other direct tax, basically unless you are taxing the number of people in the state, which makes no sense at all. And that includes income tax. It's also unconstitutional, which is why the Congress implemented the 16th Amendment that allowed an income tax. Like, an income tax would not be constitutional unless it was for were it not for the fact that the 16th Amendment came along and said, you can do income taxes. And the 16th Amendment basically allows income taxes, but it doesn't allow wealth taxes. That's the general consensus on this one. So you can get wealth taxes at the state level. You can't get them at the federal level. Now, the good news about the Wyden version of this is that it wasn't actually a wealth tax. It was an income tax. It was a tax on capital gains, which counts as income. Whether that argument would pass muster with the current Supreme Court, we don't know. But certainly, like, not all billionaires would pay this tax, right? If you own Revlon, say, and you've lost billions of dollars over the past few years, but you're still a billionaire, then you have no capital gains and you owe no tax. It's not a tax on the wealth that you have. It's just a tax on the capital gains. And it would have been like a massive, massive tax. You know, it would be effectively 23.8% of the net worth of all of the big entrepreneurial billionaires like Elon Musk, one-off big tax, which they'd pay over 5 years. And then every year after that, they'd pay 23% of their annual capital gains. That's way bigger than what Elizabeth Warren was proposing, which was just like 2% per year.
Well, now I feel like I do understand then how it's unconstitutional. I don't understand how billionaires are ever going to pay more taxes in the United States. And I'm feeling like I agree with Stacey that this is incredibly frustrating and upsetting that we have these essentially a super class of 700 billionaires, mostly men, who don't have to, who pay less tax than I do. Like, it's incredibly frustrating. And what the Biden administration has done is basically say they're going to raise taxes on the working rich. I guess that's what we call now the millionaires, people who make a lot of money, the working rich.
Struggling by on $10 million a year.
Yeah. And just the billionaires just get a pass. It's just, it's crazy. And judging by my Twitter feed, people think this was a solution because I said, oh, the billionaires aren't going to be taxed. And people told me I was a gaslighting liar because, no, don't worry. People with incomes over, I think, 10 million will be taxed. But actually, no, the billionaires still get away kind of scot-free here.
Yeah, because the billionaires don't have incomes of over 10 million. Yeah. A lot of them have incomes of like zero or $1 or something. And they, if they need spending money, they just borrow against their stock. It's this loophole. The one thing I will say is that the United States is hardly unique in this respect. There are few, if any, countries in the world where billionaires pay a lot of tax. Billionaires, by their nature, are good at locating themselves in places where they don't have to pay tax. And
really, America's the only country which even has a chance of being able to tax billionaires because it taxes people on their global income. But billionaires are politically powerful and they have expensive lawyers and they're good at making sure that they don't pay taxes on their wealth. And, you know, you get people like Peter Thiel creating, you know, $5 billion IRAs and all of this kind of thing. In an ideal world, I think, yes, the billionaires would pay a lot of tax. I just don't think that we have ever lived in that ideal world. I don't think that that exists in any country anywhere. And while it was lovely for a brief shining 5 seconds on like Wednesday of this week to think that Ron Wyden might have come up with like a vision for that world, I don't think anyone is entirely surprised that it didn't come to pass.
Isn't that a recipe for people to take out the guillotines? Like, if these people are actually untouchable.
Well, I believe, but that's exactly what they did, right? It was called the election of Donald Trump. That, you know, you can draw a straight line from the 2008 financial crisis to the 2016 election, and like the anger that you saw in 2016 and the continued popularity of Donald Trump, I think is definitely related to it's definitely guillotine adjacent.
Yeah, it's just not in a direction that people who like to think of themselves as progressive would approve of. But I completely agree with Felix, right? I think that the degree of societal unrest in the United States, it's highly commented upon, but it's an under-examined secular trend that some politicians are better at writing than others.
And Felix, you had another kind of theory in your newsletter this week that this is just the reason the billionaire tax didn't work is because the U.S. just isn't into the socialism of it all. Which is sort of a separate thing.
So, yeah, it's a separate thing, but it's a real thing that it's like on some deep level un-American. The person who wrote famously, from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs, was Karl Marx, right? The idea that you tax people according to their ability to pay is on some level a pretty Marxist idea, right? It's not just the right wing, certainly in America, has always loved this idea of a flat tax. And you remember, like, was it Herman Cain with his 999 plan or whatever? Like, the idea being that everyone should be treated equally no matter how much money they have. And the idea that, no, we should treat the very rich differently and get more money out of them because they are the very rich and they have more ability to pay is a Marxist idea. And we are not in America a Marxist society. And although the opinion polls are showing more and more people, especially younger people, self-identifying as socialists, that's certainly not true of the United States Senate. That's certainly not true of people like Joe Manchin. And what Joe Manchin said when he killed this idea was, I don't want to single out the billionaires for higher taxes. Like, that just feels unfair. And on some level, I think that's exactly what we're seeing here, is that the broad mass of like middle America, centrist America, you know, non-progressive America just feels that there is something unfair about taxing billionaires. And I don't, but I'm not really that American. I've only been an American for, you know, a few years.
So then it feels like we've basically created a backdoor to monarchy. We're not supposed to have kings or queens and such, but I mean, if we have 700 people that are above tax policy, then yeah, we do.
But that's exactly what I mean about underanalyzed, right? Which is that one of the strangest things for me about moving to the US, given the ideals and principles upon which it was founded, was like, on the one hand, the adulation of, you know, a class of politicians that were basically royalty, for especially if you read Vanity Fair, as well as this idea that there's a class of people who, just because they were good at making money, should be allowed to infinitely make money, and questioning that is wild, and somehow suggesting that, you know, cool, also it would be good if, because of the ways in which you benefited in order to be able to build that money, like from, you know, tax subsidies on your HQ in New York or Seattle or Austin, or using the social safety nets because you are not offering paid leave of any kind, that that's something that you, you know, put back into a functioning capitalist system is a bridge too far in kind of a lot of the rhetoric here. And like, I have always just like, as a person who didn't experience that in other places, have been baffled by it.
To be clear, in the case of the richest person in the world, Elon Musk, he didn't just benefit from the basic societal affordances that that America gives entrepreneurs. He actually got hundreds of millions of dollars in direct federal loans and grants to build Tesla and SolarCity. And not to mention the fact that SpaceX, his other company, where he has, you know, $40 billion worth of stock, is, you know, it basically has one client, which is the American government. Okay, let's keep talking about Elon Musk, since he's not only rich, but he is selling 100,000 Teslas to Hertz. This is great for Tesla, obviously. He's selling them basically at full price. It is so good for Tesla, in fact, that it managed to push up the market capitalization of Tesla in one day by 2x the market capitalization of Ford, pushing Tesla into the $1 trillion club. Well done, Elon. It's also good for Hertz, which is going to be 20% electric pretty soon. Yay. And it is also weirdly good for Uber. This is something that only came out a day or two later, that half of these cars you're not going to be able to rent just by turning up to your local Hertz short store and renting a car. Half of these cars are going to be reserved for Uber drivers, because in a bunch of jurisdictions, Uber is being forced to go all electric. And in fact, Uber has said, I think nationwide in the United States, it's going to be entirely electric by 2030. And so that's a problem for Uber, because most Uber drivers don't necessarily have the means to be able to buy an electric car themselves. And so what they're saying is, well, if you can't buy a car, then you can just rent it from Hertz. So here we have, in one great vat of a, you know, 1 week news cycle, we have Tesla and Hertz and Uber all getting intermingled in this one news story. Yay.
Oh, shout out to the autos reporters. Good luck. This is a bit of a wild week for y'all.
It's a really interesting story. I mean, I think it really signifies that electronic cars are going to be it's a mainstream thing now, and Tesla is going to be the brand. We already kind of knew that Tesla was going to be the brand for electric cars, but this deal
is at the moment. I don't think this is a foregone conclusion, right? Like, if you look at the latest version of the Build Back Better bill, there's an extra $4,500 of tax breaks, basically for people who are buying electric Fords or other electric cars made in the US by unionized labor, which obviously wouldn't include Tesla, which does not have unionized labor. And people are really excited about the Rivian truck. They're excited about the Ford F-150 Lightning. They're excited about the Ford Mach-E. The number of Porsche Taycans sold has already exceeded the number of Porsche 911s sold this year. And, you know, while it is definitely true that Tesla has a head start, it is not entirely obvious to me how valuable that first mover advantage is, especially when the Tesla charging network becomes interoperable with all of the other chargers. And at that point, I think there is a slightly more level playing field than you might think. And Tesla is certainly the number one player in the market today and will be for some years to come. But I don't think we can just sort of tie it up in a bow and say, well, Tesla's won and everyone else has lost.
I mean, I would push back a little bit on that. I don't think Tesla has created a brand name for itself that is extremely powerful, sexy. I mean, it has incredible brand recognition. There's no other new auto manufacturer I can think of that has been able to pull off the same since maybe like Kia or maybe Hyundai. I don't know. I live in a pretty affluent area, and I see Teslas all the time. When I talk to people, people are excited about Tesla. When I talked to people about this deal, they were like, "Ooh, I'll definitely go to Hertz, and I want to try one of these cars." Like, I just think it has a real lead on the marketing brand piece, and that's not to be discounted.
I wouldn't discount it, but what I would say is I want to jump on a word that you used, which is like affluent, right? Which is electric cars will succeed when you don't have to be willing to spend above average money for brand and above average money relative to the quality that you're actually getting. Like my friends who are very into cars, and there are a lot of them all around me, there are some Tesla drivers within there, but one of the things that they're talking about all the time is that if you are a real car aficionado, and even if you're a real electric car aficionado, there's a lot about Tesla's quality, like the finish, some of the features that appeal to you if you are a gadget person, but that are insufficiently interesting if you are a real car person, and even if you are coming at this from an electric car perspective. And Felix's point about the chargers is really, really key, right? Like when I lived in Silicon Valley, and it was like every person around me was literally buying a Tesla or a Porsche, depending on their bonus that year. One of the big things that was appealing was so many of these tech companies would offer you free or aggressively subsidized charging so that you would park your car when you got to work and you would charge your car for free and then you would drive it home, because the rate of adoption of electric cars in certain communities far outstrips the mass availability of places to charge it, even if you have a garage at home.
I think you're absolutely right, Stacey. The panel gaps and the whole value proposition of the Tesla is like, this is a really sexy computer on wheels, and then we've built like this kind of cheap and shoddily constructed box around the computer. But hey, look at the amazing screen, which does a million things. And what you care about is the amazing screen and the great acceleration and the electric bit. And car people kind of care about the box and often really dislike the screen. I have driven an electric car with acres of screen in front of me, and I hated it. And I don't want to be hunting around on the screen to work out what button I want to press. And I think there is a lot of opportunity space out there for other manufacturers to make other cars, and possibly cheaper cars, as you say, we need to have broad adoption here, that don't feel quite as gadgety. I definitely agree with Emily that Tesla has done an amazing job in terms of marketing and desirability, and a lot of people still want to buy a Tesla. But the electric car future is going to be a diverse and vibrant future with lots of players. And the only question is really what is the market share of Tesla going to be? It's not going to be 100, it's going to be less than 100. And who knows how big or how small. We're still in very, very early days. So we just don't know.
Tesla could be Mercedes or Porsche, or Tesla could be Ford or something.
I don't think Tesla's going to be Ford, right? Because Ford is trying to be Ford, right? Like the Ford F-150 Lightning has blown people's minds in terms of appealing to the aesthetic of people who like Ford trucks, but delivering on electric performance. And, the Tesla aesthetic is very specific, and it is not for everybody, particularly with some of the quality control issues that they have, which is not to say Ford has not had its own quality control issues. But I don't think that the way we move forward with mass adoption of electric is by optimizing for people who exclusively like the shiniest, gadgetiest version of a thing. I think the way we move forward with electric, and that's what's so interesting about this credit, is by making it available at every price point to people who want to get from point A to point B.
But back to the Hertz and Uber, the thing that interests me is what does this mean for Uber? If the Uber, I think we've all more or less agreed that the Uber Tesla dream of self-driving cars is not going to be here for the foreseeable future. You are going to have to get human beings leasing these cars from Hertz and sitting behind the wheel and driving around. And I just can't get the math straight in my head. Like, I understand that the amount they spend on refueling is going to be lower because it costs less to recharge than it does to fill up with gas. But these, you know, if you're paying like hundreds of dollars a week just to rent your car, that changes the economics of driving for Uber really substantially. And I suspect that people aren't going to want to do that.
Well, so one of the things that I've been looking at in like the Lyft and the Uber app is they're really trying to push what they're calling green rides. So, you know, like you can choose whatever they're calling it now, like the X in the Uber context and the XL, and then there's one called Comfort, and then there's Green. And Uber, as it has done in the past, looks like it's subsidizing the cost of the green relative to some of the other options. But, you know, according to a Wall Street Journal story that I was reading, they're paying a dollar more for every driver of an electric car per ride. So they're trying to address those mechanics, but like $1? Like, I don't know how that works out, to your point, in terms of the maths involved here.
The clear winner here seems to be maybe Hertz, that just came out of bankruptcy and got a lot of press that it wouldn't have in any other universe for doing this, right? I mean, and has differentiated itself as a rental car company in a world where rental cars are not really that big of a thing anymore, really struggling, especially since the pandemic, to stay relevant.
Yeah, they're going public soon on the NASDAQ.
Again.
Again. So, well done, Hertz, for your IPO number two. All right, I think it's time for a numbers round. Stacey, do you have a number this week?
Yes. my number is 24%. Which is how the amount that a Canadian material science firm that trades under the ticker MMAT, but is called Meta Materials, rallied on Friday because people were like, oh, Meta, that must be a Facebook thing somehow. So it was like one of the most actively traded stocks on Friday, and like I think the volume was like more than a million shares traded hands before people were like, oh, wait, never mind, metals. Yes.
Did you see the volume on Meta, which is an ETF?
Yes, the ETF.
Because it's an ETF, the price didn't go up, the volume went up like a gazillion percent. It was crazy. People, the new ticket is not Meta. The new ticket is MVRS, which I don't even know what people are going to call it. Movers?
Mervers.
Emily, what's your number?
Is cheerful. It's $10,000. That is the amount of money that Spanx CEO Sarah Blakely gave each of her employees, along with two first-class tickets to anywhere in the world they want to go this week. And there's a great little Instagram video that you can go and look at. Just the pure joy. It's mostly the Spanx workforce. It's mostly women, and it's just a delightful thing. I'm struggling to have it to feel a downside to this because the news here is that Spanx got a lot of money from Blackstone, sold themselves to Blackstone, and yeah, you should go watch the video.
$10,000 seems great.
Anyone who wants to give me two first class air tickets to anywhere in the world is just such a wonderful, like, ultra luxe, brilliant idea.
They're Delta Airlines, I think, also, so it's not like,
yes,
Southwest.
Oh, it has to be on Delta.
Yeah, but first class, because if someone gave me two not first class plane tickets, I'd be like, gee, thanks.
Delta One, whatever it's called. Yeah, that first class is nice. Yeah.
Plus, and then you got the cash to spend too, you know? It's like, it's a good gift. She knows what she's doing.
Is it taxable?
Yeah, that's the question I want to know. Like, if I take $10,000 worth of first class airfare, do I now need to pay income tax on that?
Oh, you're probably going to, I bet you don't get the whole $10,000 in cash.
Yeah, I'm going to ask any accountants who are listening to this how they may have structured this. Is this a gross up situation? What's happening?
Is there going to be a tax gross up? Spanx? The important questions.
The audience wants to know.
I have a question for Stacey in the form of a number, but I guess the number first. The number is 124,457.07, which
is such
a
specific number.
which is the number of ETH that Punk9998 sold for.
Oh.
And this is all to do with something called a flash loan. It wasn't a real sale from one person to another sale. There's this wonderful thing you can do in the crypto world, which is called a flash loan, where you basically borrow money for like an hour and a half, and you can do what you like with it because according to the smart contract, the person who lent the money is guaranteed to get it back. So they're not really taking any credit risk. And so what this guy did is he borrowed basically $532 million, took his CryptoPunk, sold it to himself, transferred it back to himself, and then paid the $532 million back just to be able to get on top of some like leaderboard and say, hey, I have a $532 million CryptoPunk. On some level, it's silly. On some level, it's funny. On some level, it's like a weird flex. But the question I have for Stacey is, how much did it cost? I want to know about these flash loans, because we know that there was like $800 in gas fees, but presumably there was an actual cost to borrowing the money on top of that that was a lot more than $800, or no?
That's actually one of the things that we're trying to report out at the moment. The invisibility of that flash loan fee is something that I find really interesting for two reasons. One is, I have had a hunch, and I am not alone in this, that these sorts of trades happen fairly frequently, usually not at the $500 million level, and that people are using it to like inflate the prices of NFTs. And then the second person who buys it, they're like, well, it sold for $400,000 before, $500,000 seems like a bargain. And two, I confess to not 100% understanding what the upside is to providing flash loans if there isn't some kind of margin that is attractive. You know, it's like, okay, it's going to be lower than if you had to, you know, actually take on credit risk, but I still want to know like what that percentage is that folks are making.
Yeah, I mean, no one loans out $500 million for free, even if it's only for an hour and a half. Like, people are going to want to get paid for that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And like, what makes that worthwhile?
So, okay, Stacey, as the managing editor for crypto at Bloomberg News, your assignment this week is to come back next week and tell us, what is the interest rate on a flash loan? I'm genuinely interested. And I know you are too.
I have multiple people giving me homework. Yes, I will come back next week with some more insights on this.
Brilliant. So I think that's it, unless you're a Slate Plus listener. I hope you're a Slate Plus listener, because we're going to talk about Succession. Well, we're not really going to talk about Succession. We're going to talk about something Succession adjacent, which is the Rogers family in Canada. Like, when we had Ed Lee on the show talking about all of the media families that Succession was based on, I can tell you that the name Rogers was not a name that appeared. But now, oh boy, it turns out to be like the most Succession-esque family in the world. We're going to talk about what's going on with them in Slate Plus. But other than that, thank you so much for listening. And thank you so much to Shayna Roth for producing. This show was a bear of a show to produce for various boring technical reasons. She is a superstar. Send your emails in to slatemoney@slate.com and tell Shayna how wonderful she is. And we will be back on Monday with more Slate Money Succession with Matt Haber, and then the following Saturday with more Slate Money.